Okay, time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy, coming to you from London. We're in London, Stacy.
Yes, we're globetrotters.
Speaking of globetrotters, you know, I saw something interesting. It's called Mr. Trotter's Pork Scratchings. It's a bag of pork scratchings, whatever that might be. And Mr. Trotter apparently is the man to know if you're interested in pork scratchings. Any idea what that might be?
Yeah, well, I had them, didn't I? Oh, I took a few. I tried them.
Oh.
They're very fatty. Imagine that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right. I did try one. It wasn't all that great. I think maybe a beef jerky would have been better, but I don't like that either.
Well, but certainly it's been fun making the shows, our Kaiser Report from this new studio.
Yeah.
It's actually a real studio. You know, it would be nice if we had a studio like that in New York as well, you know, so we can go back and forth between New York and London.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps L.A. too.
Yeah, the whole world should just have studios for us to go to everywhere. But anyway, here is in London. It's really nice. We got a good studio, and we have been, you know, we lived here about 7 years ago, didn't we?
That's right. It wasn't nearly as fun. By the way, yeah, 7 years ago, however, the economy seemed depressed compared to what it does now. It feels much more booming now. People are certainly spending more money. You see them all out at the restaurants and pubs and stuff. Though the other thing as well is they must be spending more money because you didn't really have a restaurant culture back then. 7 years ago, like you do now, there's so many restaurants. People used to just go to the pub and drink, you know, 15 pints of beer before closing. Now they go to a restaurant, it seems.
Well, you see, here's the deal. Over the past 7 years, interest rates have come down. You know, the quantitative easing and these types of things means that the interest on gilts, you know, your British Treasury bonds, have come down. And so people with large sums of cash need to generate returns on that cash in excess of the 1% or 2% they're getting in the gilt market and to try to stay ahead of inflation. So that money moves out of the gilt market and into things like hotels, restaurants, and other development, retailing. Simultaneously, of course, folks are diving into indebtedness. The country's indebtedness numbers are continuing to go higher. You have Fitch now. It's talking about downgrading the UK, getting rid of its AAA status because the economy is shrinking. So the economy is shrinking. The employment picture is shrinking. Wages are shrinking. Trade is shrinking. By every metric, things are shrinking. But because of and the response of the central bank, the Bank of England, is to lower interest rates, which has the perverse outcome of making the top 1% a lot wealthier by it's simultaneously disenfranchising the bottom 99%. So either they're doing that by design because, you know, their constituency is obviously the very wealthiest. That's been the case since, 1694 when the Bank of England was first set up. That's been during the transition from feudalism to post-feudalism, the toffs and the aristos wanted to preserve part of the old world order, and they created the Bank of England to become this overarching lordship. And now we see what it's all about here in the year 2012, where the economy is collapsing, but instead of allowing the collapse to play through, like they did in Iceland, much to their benefit, or as has happened in previous down cycles, much to the long-term benefit of the economy, they're trying an experiment where they are going to flood the market with easy credit for the top percent, and see how badly imbalanced this economy can get. And so your observation that it seems like a boom from 7 years ago, it's totally booming for the top 1%. You know, if you go, they're buying watches, you know, 20,000, 30,000 pound watches are flying off the shelf. But, you know, the economy everywhere else in the country is deteriorating. You know, that's what we're seeing.
I think it's also more than that. You know, in my economics course at UCLA, we needed to do an economic history of our families to show the cycles. Everybody was like trying to get into exploring economic cycle through their own families. And my dad's family, they had jobs for, at that time, I guess the hospitals, a lot of hospitals in America used to be government run or government somehow. But my grandparents on my dad's side, they worked at a hospital. And so they didn't lose their job during the Great Depression. So consequently, they actually said that they did very well because they still had the same income, but deflation was everywhere around them. So prices were going down, so they lived a better life. Now, obviously, over 25% of the population lost their jobs, but they got to keep it, and it was good for them. Now, here in the UK, most people, unlike the US, where most people are on fixed rate mortgages, you know, most Americans will fix their interest rate on their mortgage for 25, 30 years. Here, most people do a floating rate mortgage. So it floats with the base rate. And I know, for example, a friend of mine here who she did lose her job and she has been unemployed for over a year, but her mortgage payment went from, it was like 750, close to 750, and now it's just under 400 per month because of the base rate going down to zero. Imagine if she had still had a job. So there are lots of people in that situation that still have a job, but they have another £400, or, you know, she had a pretty low mortgage. Some people have big mortgages and it's cut in half their payments.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first point about the Depression, if you have a public sector job, you know, the government, if you recall, was pumping money through the public into the public sector. Mm-hmm. But since then, since Reagan period and Thatcher period, you have this trend toward privatization. So now there is no public sector to keep afloat. You have only the private sector. So, for example, Walmart is going to hire 50,000 people for Christmas to work part-time, helping people get deeper and deeper into debt. Mm-hmm. And then next January, they'll all be fired again. Those people don't get benefits. Those people don't get any kind of work history. Those people are just temporary workers, and that's another big trend is people end up just working as temporary workers. So as the privatization, now, where we just came from France, and France, of course, is an economy that's called a mixed economy, so it's half government, half private. And during downturns, as we saw in 2007, 2008, 2009, the government kicked in and immediately lowered taxes on restaurant food. Mm. You know, the government immediately hired lots of people to go clean Notre Dame, you know, and do projects. So the government kicked in to pick up the slack. You know, in kind of the Keynesian theory is that the government should be there when to pick up the slack. And then when the economy starts to pick up again, the government recedes more into the background. And in France, you see this in practice, really, and they actually follow that kind of methodology. Whereas in the States or in the UK, during every downturn, you see, or upturn, doesn't really matter. Both the private and the public sectors keep growing. There's no balance at all. They're both completely out of control. So there is no attempt to balance things. And one thing, remember a few years ago, we were in Amsterdam, and in the local paper, they carried in the business section a number called purchasing power. And it said, this week, your purchasing power was up or down. Now, that number should be carried in every paper around the world to sort of give people the real picture of what their purchasing power is in these economies. And in the UK and the US, that number would be collapsing right now as we see the price of food and energy and things like this continue to go up. And then people would see in black and white that things are not right.
Well, there's another thing I want to say about that, because I have a little different opinion there. I think that, you know, as I was saying about my grandparents, they were living very well. That's because there was deflation. Things actually got cheaper at the supermarket. Prices actually went down. They saw them noticeably go down, and yet their income stayed the same. We do not see that in any shop. No shop or restaurant in town will you see that the prices have gone down in this deflationary collapse. Asset prices, however, derivative asset prices, those sort of assets, financial assets, have gone down. However, the rich have been made whole on the previous 100% value of those by the government. That's the new Keynesianism. That's where there was 100% bailout on that. The rich, the owners of those assets, as we see now with the latest quantitative easing to infinity, what the Fed is going to do is buy $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities and other assets like that every single month until infinity. So these investors, the investor class, gets made whole. The Wall Street Journal wrote about this policy and said it was accidental that the rich are going to be made better off than the poor. And in fact, that it's also accidental that this policy will hurt the poor from inflation down the road, which will hurt workers more than it will hurt the investor class, like Romney, who doesn't have to work, but he makes an income on his investments. So he will be made continue to live well based on the Fed buying up his assets, financial assets. But by the Fed buying up his financial assets, the workers will be harmed even further.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So, in terms of deflation, back in the 30s, and, living relatively well back in the 30s as prices went down and your incomes remained the same. Of course, you had the gold standard back then, so there was a genuine benchmark against which prices could be measured. We don't have that anymore, and so on a relative basis, prices continue to rise because there's nothing but fiat money being pumped into the system. But this word deflation, of course, from the consumer side, it is good. People want to pay less for stuff. Mm. But you only hear it being characterized as bad from, like, the Wall Street Journal, who is, of course, they like inflation because it means more bonds and stocks to sell. During a deflation, the pipeline of bonds and stocks that come through Wall Street diminishes. It goes down because there's no demand for it. So they hate deflation, even though people obviously on the consumer side would want to pay less for stuff. The other big deflation trend, of course, in the past 30 or 20 years is when China joined the World Trade Organization and then allowed U.S. and U.K. corporations to outsource their labor force to China. In the U.S. and in the U.K., that meant that prices of stuff like clothes, textiles, and electronics deflated. They went down a lot. So they had, you're paying less for that stuff. But it was, wasn't the result of an outright monetary deflation in terms of the speed and creation of money diminishing. And then you have that strange quirk in the inflation deflation equation where they say that in the electronics industry, if the processing speed of a computer goes up, then prices are deflating. So the Apple computer is twice as powerful this year than last year. The price is the same, but the government considers that to be half the price of what it was last year because they say it's twice as fast.
Well, the other thing, staying on this topic, that we didn't have in the Great Depression was the rapid ability to transfer enormous amounts of wealth to the empire. So there's lots of money laundering to both the U.S., New York in particular, and London. And you see that with, as they were reporting this past week, that most of the new build, they're building all these new apartment complexes and condo complexes all over London. And there are more Hong Kong and Singapore buyers than there are British buyers. So it's a lot of money coming from wealth created somewhere else and brought here, not for purposes of building more wealth, but to basically launder their money, take it out of their own nations at any cost. You know, you saw that a recent report came out looking back at the collapse of Russia post Yeltsin Russia. Well, Yeltsin Russia, where all these American-backed oligarchs withdrew $600 billion, they reckon, from Russia. $600 billion in natural resource wealth and other wealth sources from Russia. So, you know, this is a destabilizing factor for these other nations while also helping out the nations that are considered legitimate forces. So the US can bomb anybody that's been determined to be legitimate, that they can, there's no way they could ever do an illegal invasion. Even when Kofi Annan, who was at the UN, said the US invasion of Iraq was illegal, that didn't mean anything because mm-hmm. we consider them legitimate. So, you know, there's this massive wealth, like hundreds of billions can flow in just a day from Hong Kong to New York City. And it causes deflation, collapse, and destabilization in the place it's being taken from. But obviously, in this sort of circumstance we're seeing now, it's flowing into the places from which a lot of the financial crimes happened.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, if you're one of these oligarchs and you extract $100 billion, you put it in the bank and you only get like $50 at the end of the year in interest.
Yeah.
Because interest rates are near zero.
Yeah.
So if you buy income producing real estate, you buy residential real estate, you get an income on that money. So they're driving the price, even if the price of the building and the real estate doubles and triples and quadruples, you see, you're still getting more of an income than you would if you put it into government bonds. And since they're all doing that simultaneously, they're creating this new bubble. So you have, which is another interesting idea, is that in the U.S., and you have strength in pockets of the real estate market. And the question is this the beginning of the turnaround in that economy, or is it another bubble? So, I mean, there's a case to be made that it could be another bubble because the underlying economy is still falling apart. The fact that you've got people speculating, certainly in Florida, you've got money coming in from Brazil and other places, and they're driving in there because interest rates are so low. Seems like it's going to come to an abrupt halt. I think also in Ireland, the bond market, which has been up for 18 months sharply, I think that's now in a bubble. I think the Irish debt market is in a bubble. The IMF and these people are still playing around with Ireland. They're still saying that we're not going to cover your bets. You still have to impose austerity measures. And, you know, it's not out of the woods. It's not like in Iceland. It's more like a Spain. So more like a Greece. So I think that's in a bubble. So those countries, that countries in down, going to be down, going down, down, down.
But that's how you know we're still a very long way from the end of this Great Depression, because we're still in a mindset which got very much, you know, wrenched out of the population, the mind of the population of America, that they were over speculation. They did not do speculation,
no, speaking of speculation.
For another 40, 50, 60 years. What?
Yeah, speaking of speculation and bubbles, I mean, there's a massive collapse forming right now in the student loan market. It's bigger than the subprime, $1 trillion plus.
Yeah, but so I'm saying our mindset is still favoring bubbles. We're just looking for the next bubble. I got the email from Dr. Housing Bubble. I'm on their newsletter, their link, whatever. And, you know, they were talking about flipping, house flipping coming back to Los Angeles, certain sectors of Los Angeles. So he looked at a house in Silver Lake or Los Feliz that somebody had bought just last year for $200,000 and they just flipped it for $500,000. So, you know, this mindset is returning and it's not going to stop. We're not going to hit bottom until we stop speculating and we start producing wealth, because flipping houses might help an individual. It does not help build the wealth of that nation.
Well, in Detroit, you know, a year ago, they're buying houses for $2,000 out of bankruptcy court. Now they're selling them for $40,000 and $50,000. And so it's a huge flipping mentality in Detroit. But it doesn't, I mean, it's not sustainable. You know, it's, so you have these waves of speculation. But the overall economy, coast to coast, is still falling apart. You know, municipalities are still going broke. You still have the incursion into the economy from the private sector, you know, predators who are doing everything they can to dismantle the economy and turn it into you know, their private fiefdom. So. I think that the student loan bubble, which is in the process now of bursting, could set in motion another round of major bank failures, or at least one major bank going bust. And then all this bubble activity and house flipping comes to a halt again, and prices collapse again. So what good was any of that?
Well, the unique thing about the student loan bubble situation is in America, you cannot discharge student debt. But it's very, 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 very difficult. It's like extreme cases. Does it ever get discharged? So that could be the real, you know, this first wave was with these jingle mail mortgage loans, where those are non-recourse loans in America. So you could walk away from your mortgage debt and say bye-bye and just go move to the other side of the country, move across town and just start a new life with no responsibility for that debt. With the student loans, they can't escape them. So where does that go? Because this is a new, different wave. Now, when those same people, perhaps their parents, walked away from their mortgage debts, some banks did crumble, but then the government, and we see this with the Fed now with QE3, are buying up those debts from the banks because the banks are now walking away from those mortgages as well. But is the government going to come in and do the same for the population that they did for the banksters? No. So what's going to happen with all of these student debts, over $1 trillion now of outstanding student debts?
Right. So what we get a timeline begins to materialize. You had the stock market crash of 87. Then you had the dot-com crash of 2000, and then followed by the subprime crash of 2005-2006 era. And so now people are looking at the housing market, and they're looking at relative strength in a few areas, and they're saying, aha, there is a recovery in the pipeline, but they're ignoring now the collapse of a new huge bubble, the student loan bubble. So this is going to, just like subprime caught everyone off guard, and they said basically that subprime, remember, before the bubble burst, the real estate market had been disintermediated and democratized, and risk was completely equally distributed through the system, and that we had entered a new permanent era of prosperity, and all the kind of phraseology you hear just before the bubble pops. And so it popped. Now people are not really looking at the student loan market in terms of its ramifications through the banking sector and the global banking sector as it pops now. So all of the discussion of inflation and deflation and relative strength and real estate and wages and labor and China and America and the UK, these are all very interesting cross currents that are moving pieces around the chessboard of the global economy, but there is one major factor which is now emerging, and that is that we are on the precipice of a major bubble burst, and this is in the student loan area.
Well, perhaps you'll see unrest one day because of that. I know Americans aren't very much like that, not since the 1930s, but you know, you could see a situation like Spain. Look at Spain this past week, honey.
Yeah, well, they're heating up, right? The indignados have now become the outright, torch burners.
Yeah, and the Catalan wants to secede, right? So the wealthy area wants to leave the country.
Right. So Spain is deteriorating, and they're going down the pipe. And I've said on this show, of course, that if you look at the Europe situation, I've described it as a controlled demolition in a lot of ways. And so here's some evidence to that effect. The economies that are crashing in Europe have done so in the order of their vulnerability to being attacked and size. So, of course, Iceland blew up, and it's one of the smallest economies in the entire area. Now they are a separate case because they threw out the banksters. But then they went after Ireland, which was a $350 billion economy. Then they went after Greece and Portugal, again, sub $500 billion economies. And the folks that are engineering these collapses, they use the profits from crashing these economies to build up their war chest to go after a bigger economy, in this case, Spain. So Spain is now on the rotisserie being roasted to death by the banksters. From Spain, I would imagine they go to Italy. And Italy will be, and of course, Italy has 2,400 tons of gold that they have actually in the country. So that's a huge prize that they're working to get. And then once Italy is taken out, then it's down to the two major players that have defined the past 100 years of modern warfare in Europe, and that's France and Germany.
Well, on Spain, so like I said, Catalonia is threatening secession. Now, the Catalans, by and large, according to this Business Insider piece, do not like being part of Spain. A recent survey, the last time there was a referendum on the issue, 95% of those voted wanted Catalonia to leave Spain. So that was in 2009 that they took that poll, the referendum. And now the head of that region is threatening secession because it's Spain's largest region by output, accounting for 18.7% of Spain's total GDP. It is also the most indebted. Its total debts of 42 billion euros are worth nearly 4% of the entire country's economic output, and it asked for a 5 billion euro bailout from the central government recently. And now that Rajoy, the reason why they're demanding secession is that Rajoy is asking them to submit to the Troika. And they're saying, no, we didn't borrow money from the Troika. We borrowed money from the central government, and we're not going to be slaves to the Troika. Now, I mean, this is something that's very different to what you see in Italy. I remember when I was living in Los Angeles, I was going to UCLA, and I was taking a Spanish course there, and there was a guy named Carlos Pugh living in our building. And I asked him, because he was from Spain, for some help on my Spanish work. And he said, well, I don't speak Spanish. And I said, what? How can you not speak Spanish? He said, well, I live near Barcelona, and we would never speak Spanish because I could not marry a Spanish woman because I would be disowned and I would lose my inheritance. And so it's a very deep sort of hatred in Spain. Obviously, Franco was very, let's say, aggressive towards the Catalan. But that's something you don't see, the secessionist sort of movements happening, certainly not in Germany, certainly not in Italy.
Mm, Yeah, well, that's what happens during these downturns is that people, you know, they go at each other. And it ends up in things like world wars, right?
Yeah.
Pre-World War One, World War Two. So the animosities are coming out. During the good times, people look the other way. But during the downturns, you know, everyone remembers that they hated everybody else. So they start to get at each other's throat. And so this is what's happening in Europe. Obviously, the Greeks are extremely angry at the Germans, and that's opening up old wounds. And you see that happening across the Eurozone. But the Troika, of course, and the IMF and these groups are backed by an even bigger banking cartel above them, which would be Bank of International Settlements and various central banks. And those guys are thinking about bringing in a global currency like a special drawing right. So if Spain loses its sovereignty the way Greece has, the way Ireland has, and they swap all of their bad debt for European federal debt, then in 2 years' time, all that debt, which will be worthless, will be swapped for new global debt. And we have seen a major indication of this week when the World Health Organization announced that they are looking at bringing in a global tax on cigarettes. So this is, as far as I can tell, the first time that I've seen a global organization looking to bring about a global tax. I brought that up just recently. Somebody said, well, they tried to bring in a global tax on airlines, I guess that was brought up and then defeated. But this is, if it goes through, then you have this a world organization bringing in global taxes. So behind that would be a global central bank, which would introduce a global tax so that, let's say, in America, people would pay state, local, federal, and global tax. And the taxes, of course, would have the effect of making people poorer and feeding the central banksters, and the trend continues.
Well, there's another, you know, when they do those sort of things, they start it just like this whole war on terror. They choose really scary looking guys to the normal person and say, look, we're only suspending habeas corpus because of these guys. Do you want them to get away with these crimes? Don't you want us to make you safe from these guys? And that's when, you know, then you accept the principle of suspending habeas corpus. And then when they come for you and you don't have habeas corpus, well, tough luck, buddy. And on the other side, they also come in with like, look, we're going to give you something for free, for nothing, and suspend your disbelief or suspend your integrity as a human being and let us control everything. IMF to use windfall gold profit for loans to poor members, says Bloomberg News this morning. The International Monetary Fund said today it agreed to distribute $2.7 billion in windfall profits from gold sales to subsidize loans to poor countries. The IMF's 188 members will receive a payment in proportion to their weight within the institution, the IMF said in an emailed statement today. As a precondition, however, countries must give assurances that they'll make at least 90% of the $2.7 billion available to a trust fund that lends to low-income countries at 0% interest rates. The strategy endorsed today by the executive board ensures the IMF is better positioned to help our low-income members absorb future shocks and underpin their efforts to achieve stronger sustainable economic growth, said Christine Lagarde. The gold sales took place in 2009 to 2010 as part of the fund's plans to shore up its finances. It brought in about $3.8 billion more than expected because of higher than anticipated gold prices. The IMF already agreed to use about $1.1 billion of windfall profit through the same process, and member countries are close to giving assurances they will distribute 90% from that round to poor countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, they would do a much better thing if they simply distributed gold to the people.
Exactly.
The people don't need to have the gold liquidated and then be given a loan. So you're turning gold, something of value, into something of negative value, a loan. They say it's a negative interest rate, but they don't mention that the increase in the paper will create inflation to make your purchasing power collapse. So it's not negative. It's not a 0% interest. It's you have to adjust for the real inflationary impact, which is going to be negative 2, 3, 4, 5, 10%, and combine it with all these other money printing schemes. So it's another money printing scheme. They're liquidating gold. And
but are they, honey? Because that's the thing, is you could say, okay, they are creating paper. They're handing out this $3.8 billion, but are they, like, how are we, where is the so-called IMF gold? Where was it held? Who sold it? Who bought it? Who transferred this so-called gold? Where is the proof that there was ever any gold that was liquidated? And so is this a sort of new scheme that we could see rolled out of, look, we sold another 100 tons of gold last year. Here, people, enjoy your share of the wealth. This is a way to accept this paper money printing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. They don't have any real, there's no, the IMF famously, when you look at the table of who owns the gold, I mean, there's a big asterisk next to the IMF's position because it's not, there's no, there hasn't been any accounting for it. There's been no audit.
Yeah.
They just say, well, we have this gold and, you know, we're the IMF, so you have to take our word for it. And, but right, they can just distribute more money. It's just more money printing, but they don't want to call it money printing because that would obviously, it suggests that their policies are failing. So they say, well, we're selling this gold and we're going to distribute the proceeds, even though we don't have any evidence of this gold. But so it gives them a story. It gives them a narrative to sound as though, and the windfall profits. Well, you know, and it's funny that the Christine Lagarde would refer to a gold sale as windfall profit, whereas a Warren Buffett would say that gold is worthless and has no value, and buying and selling it is a waste of time because it's not an asset class. It's just rocks that some people collect. You know, Ben Bernanke referred to it as, you know, a collectible. People are hobbyists, that they like to collect gold. And, you know, so, but here, Christine Lagarde is saying, well, it's an asset class that we manage and we sold it and we have the windfall profits and we're going to distribute them. She doesn't seem to be on the same page as everybody else, or she's just telling a parallel lie, of course.
It's a lie. I mean, this is the same ruse that the U.S. Federal Reserve, we made windfall profits on our dollars that we ourselves create and print. And look, we shifted one section from here. Is it just an accounting thing? There's no way they sold anything. They transferred something on a digital spreadsheet from one side to the other and said, oh, look, we made a windfall profit. Here's the books. We never cook books. Our books are perfect.
Yeah, they say that with, like, TARP. They say TARP was profitable.
Yeah.
They say the General Motors bailout was profitable. Okay, then why is the debt ceiling just going up over $16 trillion? Why is the debt of the Federal Reserve balance sheet now getting over $3 trillion, heading to $6 trillion? Why are these debts keep escalating? Because you're just talking nonsense. You're saying there's no profit. I mean, there might be on, you know, if you had Arthur Andersen, who did the books for Enron, or if you have, you know, PricewaterhouseCooper or any of these other bankrupt, corrupt accounting agencies, they can cook your books any way you want to show anything you want them to show. You can show that, you know, TARP resulted in an increase in zebra production in Kenya. You know, that's according to TARP. You know, it's according to Arthur Andersen. That's according to the accountant. But look at the bigger picture. You know, the debts are going up, up, up.
That's right. And now here's the other fucked up stupid lie, obviously, about this article. So IMF to use windfall gold profit for loans to poor members. But what they're doing is they say, so let's pretend for argument's sake that they have made this windfall profit. They're distributing this windfall profit of $2.7 billion to their 188 members who will give assurances that they will then distribute this $2.7 billion divided between 188 members according to their weight in the organization. So what, like, what is the U.S.? Like 30% of the IMF? No, they're supposed to then loan it out, 90% of it, to poor countries. Well, a lot of those 188 members are poor countries, including Greece, Italy, France, Spain. Those are some of the largest. Japan, the biggest debt in the world. So, you know, what sort of, are they just going to say, yeah, okay, we're going to lend it to ourselves?
Yeah, well, first of all, you notice there's like three or four people getting in the middle to make the loans. So they all charge a fee. Of course, and so by the time all this money trickles out of the bankster pipeline, it's going to be almost completely gone. Just as always, like, you know, they give away grain to people in Africa, and then it goes through five or six intermediaries, and then you see photos of some woman there with a teacup. You know, that's her allocation for the year. Meanwhile, all the lords, the drug lords, and the gun runners got everything in between. So here you have all the intermediary banksters. But again, they're just making loans because they're over indebted and they're making up more loans to create the problem of having too many loans. And that the problem is that people don't need more loans. The problem is that people's purchasing power needs to be preserved. And you can only do that by having currencies backed by stuff that has shown its propensity to maintain purchasing power. So then, well, there's only one choice, really. Two choices, gold and silver. That's it.
Well, you know, during the first Great Depression, there was this, the alchemist used to try to turn lead into gold. And there were actually some Germans trying to come up with the ideas of extracting gold from the ocean to pay off all these debts that Germany owed. And then they couldn't figure out how to do that. They weren't able to do that, so they went to war instead. And they elected Hitler. But, you know, now we have the opposite. We're turning gold into lead brick, you know, toxic loans that will weigh down these countries and devastate their futures.
Right. Well, if you look up reverse alchemist in the dictionary, you'll see Gordon Brown's photo. You know, he's the biggest of them all, didn't he? Sold half of Britain's gold, 300 tons, to create paper that had the effect of inflationary impact. And, you know, so far, I mean, he sold it when gold was $250 an ounce. Now it's at $1,700 an ounce. You know, Lagarde talks about windfall profits. I mean, how much of an idiot? No wonder that Gordon Brown was over at some conference, right? And they said, oh, come here, Gordon Brown. And how many people showed up? One? They canceled it.
It was a press conference at the UN General Assembly. And he's apparently some U.S. special envoy, a UN special envoy for education. And over the loudspeakers, they were like, at 4 o'clock, they were saying, just a reminder that there's a press conference with former Prime Minister Gordon Brown in room 501. Anyway, nobody showed up. They issued a few reminders. Nobody, just one person showed up. And then there was an announcement at 4:20 saying, the press conference with former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has been canceled. And he was seen leaving the building.
Well, that's what happens when you stupidly sell half of your nation's wealth to banksters for no reason, you know.
Yeah, well, he called it a windfall profit at the time. Here's a windfall profit of, you know, I sold this gold for $1 billion, right? It's now worth like $20
billion. Yeah, I guess because they had it on the books for $35 an ounce. And so he sold it for $250 an ounce, you know, because that's the way that they were valuing it on their books. And so now it's at $1,700, going to, you know, heading to $10,000 an ounce. And as the, you know, it's a shame.
Max, that's what they're just saying there. That's what they're suggesting. The windfall profit comes because it was more than expected because of the higher anticipated gold prices. Well, that's stupid. Like, oh, those were the prices. That was the price on the market for gold. How can you say that, like, oh, we didn't know it was that much. We thought it was $35 an ounce.
If you're selling gold for paper and then you're leveraging that paper to create more paper, the price of gold will go up because you're destroying the purchasing power. So it's like, okay, take a teeter-totter board, okay, and you put it lengthwise in front of you on a table, on top of, let's say, a can, and then on one side, opposite your face, put a, you know, some buckshot, or, you know, maybe half a pound worth of lead. And then, so here's the state. So you got a teeter-totter in front of you with a half pound of lead staring you in the face. And take your fist and pound it as hard as you can on the teeter-totter directly under your nose. And then when that half pound lead bullet pounds your forehead and leaves an indentation in your skull, then turn around and explain why that was a shock, how that was a surprise, how you never saw that coming. How the laws of physics simply, you know, couldn't have possibly applied in this case. And that's the same argument people make when they say that we've never saw the price of gold going higher, even though we kept flooding the economy with trillions of dollars worth of paper, destroying the very currency in which gold is traded in. We couldn't have possibly seen the price go higher. So you know that the gold is not in a bubble, because if it wasn't a bubble, every time some idiot like Christy Lagarde or Gordon Brown said a stupid thing like that, the public outcry would be outrageous. They'd be like, you are the biggest moron in the world. But because the public still believes this type of thing, you know that gold is not even begun its major bull market, which will carry it to over $10,000 an ounce. Because people just don't even see how stupid that comment is yet, but they will.
So, over in France, you see they introduced this so-called austerity budget, and they've done it kind of the opposite, I guess, from what, you know, Spain, Italy, Greece, the UK are doing in over here. They're cutting services to the middle class and poor, and cutting taxes on the very wealthy and investors, and raising costs to the middle class and poor. There, they've introduced this tax on the 3,000 millionaires in that nation. It's unbelievable that there's only 3,000 there. You know, I'm sure they're mostly hidden. I'm sure there's more hidden, because there's no, like, we know, we have a friend there. I'm sure he's not counted in the millionaire class, but we know, you know, for a fact, you know, our friend Dennis is a millionaire. If you count up the truth.
Well, it's on income. So Dennis has no income at all.
Yeah.
But he has owns a vineyard that's worth, because it's next door to Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt's vineyard. So it's worth about 20 million euros. Yeah. But he has no income.
Yeah.
So he's not going to be subject to that tax. If you are a CEO and you work at a big company and your income is a million euros or more, then you're now going to get hit with a 75% tax. So now, you know, it sounds awfully high. Now, I'm just trying to think, okay, in America, if you add up state, local, and federal tax and you're in the top tax bracket, you pay close to 50% tax. Okay, so now you're comparing 50% to 75% tax. Okay, now let's say then in America, you pay for your health care, you pay for education and get hugely in debt, and you pay lots of parking tickets and things because the infrastructure is collapsing and they need to milk people to try to keep that glued together. So when you add back those items, you pay more than 75%.
Yeah. Well, we actually had a friend who was a South African, John, remember? And he was working in Chicago as the head of a giant division of a giant international ad agency. He was transferred to Paris. And so coming from Chicago to Paris, and the first year he had to do his taxes, had this accounting come, and he was so certain, because of the propaganda, that it was going to be a lot more than what he was paying in the U.S. And he said it was, in fact, a lot less. And he was totally surprised, because he was earning more here than he was earning when he was in Chicago. And yet his tax, the actual amount total, was less here than what he had paid in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, people in the U.S. who are making $1 million a year, they often, you know, you hear them complaining that they don't make any money. How do we know that they don't make any money? Because their debt ratios keep going higher and higher. So if you have, you're making $1 million a year, but you have, let's say, three or four kids, they're, now you're paying all their education, all their health, right there, plus all these other costs. So you don't, you have to go into debt. So these people are in debt. So they take out huge mortgages, or they remortgage their house, and they have now another huge piece of debt. And then the economy down turns down. They lose their job, and they don't have any health care. They don't have any anything like this. So they end up homeless. So this is how you have 46 million people officially that are at or below the poverty line. And then if you were to do an honest accounting, you'd come up with a number closer to 100 million people. Homeless rates zooming higher, number of people on food stamps, all-time highs. It's because the economy is not self-generating. The economy is it's a speculative economy that has some winners occasionally, but for the most part, like around any casino, you know, most of the people there are losing money hand over fist and are in dire straits.
Well, with that, we should be playing out some Dire Straits music if we were there live at Resonance 104.4 FM, as we were planning on doing. However, they could not find any engineer to stay on until now, 7 o'clock p.m. Well, it's now 8 p.m. But, you know, we are going to go live one day once we find an engineer for Resonance 104.4 FM to be there on a Saturday night. And that's
it. If you know how to engineer a radio show, let us know. You can do our show. Residence is no longer has any engineers that do shows. But if you can do that type of thing, let us know. Be our engineer. Okay, bye, y'all.